Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. 10 years and one day ago, we had our very first episode of Media Matters here. We've been on the air every Sunday from 1 to 2 ever since. And we had as our first guest, John Nichols, who's been our guest, I think, most of the times by far of anyone in Media Matters history. And he'll be here for the full hour to join us for our special 10th anniversary edition. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. John Christie and Naomi Shalit took on two big enterprises in 2010. They got married and they started a nonprofit investigative news outlet in Maine. What does the former have to do with the latter? More and more couples are navigating the digital age of journalism together, according to a recent article in the Columbia Journalism Review. Both Christie and Shalit are veteran reporters and editors who saw a need for real investigative journalism in Maine after existing media outlets slashed their budgets for statehouse reporting. They turned to each other, pooling their talents to create the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting and the online publication Pine Tree Watchdog.
I think one of the advantages is that there's never a time when you're not working on the stories. Get up in the morning, you talk about them. With dinner, you talk about them. The organization gets the benefit of much more than 40 hours each for the week. The disadvantage is that you kind of never get to leave it. Some days you'll look at each other and say, my God, we've got to stop working and have a life for a little while.
Christie said operating a newsroom as a couple has pros and cons.
She's, I would say, a more dogged researcher than I am. She'll go one step even further than I would. I bring a lifetime of editing and writing skills as an editor and writing coach to the table. We make a pretty good combination. And when a story gets out there and it gets good play in all our media partners and is paid attention to by the people who can make a difference, then for that moment, we feel like we've contributed to society just a little bit.
Christie is especially proud of a story he co-wrote with Shalit on Maine's archaic system for setting bail. It's set not by a judge, but by amateur bail commissioners. Nailing stories like this is a shared passion for the couple.
It gives you, as a couple, a whole other area to be involved with each other on, and if you can make the accommodations in your life to do that and make sure you fit some other things in, it makes for a very lively relationship.
The center distributes its stories to media outlets across the state and trains reporters in what Christie called evidence-based, nonpartisan, non-ideological journalism. To read stories by Christie and Shalit, visit pinetreewatchdog.org.
This month, the Supreme Court will decide whether to hear a copyright case that could have big ramifications for consumers and businesses across the country that sell or lend copies of copyrighted goods. The United States Courts of Appeals for the Second Circuit recently held a graduate student liable for buying copies of textbooks in Thailand and reselling them in the United States. Public Knowledge, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a brief asking the Supreme Court to review the decision. They say the ruling could harm both consumers and retailers who participate in secondary markets. Jody Griffin is a staff attorney at Public Knowledge.
The case was brought by a publisher called John Wiley & Sons, who makes textbooks. And they have a financial interest in bringing this case because they sell their textbooks for different prices in different countries. And they are particularly expensive in the United States. So if United States students can buy books at a cheaper price from resellers from other countries, then that will cut into the publisher's profits.
The way the law sees it, a book or a CD is a copy of a copyrighted work. When you purchase one, there's a provision in the law called the first sale doctrine that allows you to sell, give away, or lend that copy without getting permission from the copyright owner. The Second Circuit decision says that the first sale doctrine applies only to copies that are manufactured in the United States.
This could affect a lot of goods and a lot of services because so many things that we encounter in our daily lives now contain copyrighted works, things that you wouldn't necessarily think of as computers that have protected copyrighted programs inside them.
We're not only talking about books, CDs, and movies. This decision could affect a host of items, including toys and cars.
A lot of cars nowadays have computers in them, and if that computer has a copyright-protected program inside it and it was made outside of the United States, then under this interpretation, even after you've bought the car, you can't resell it or give it to somebody else without the copyright owner's permission.
Griffin says the court decision creates an incentive to move U.S. manufacturing abroad to obtain perpetual distribution rights. She hopes the Supreme Court will reverse the Second Circuit's decision or at least clarify the law so Congress can make some changes.
We live in a world that was never contemplated when Congress wrote the copyright laws. These are laws that maybe made sense back before computers and back before we had global markets for so many goods. But now it's becoming more and more apparent that copyright law is no longer really reflective of the realities of the world that we live in some important ways.
Since the Supreme Court hasn't decided whether to hear this case, the Second Circuit decision will stand for Connecticut, New York, and Vermont. For more information, go to publicknowledge.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Coming to you on the 10th anniversary of Media Matters, and it is a real privilege to have with me here to celebrate the 10 years and talk about the state of the world and American politics and world politics, none other than our frequent co-host, every time we're shaking you for money, and also every time he writes a book, which is like every 6 months, it seems like.
It's not quite that frequently.
John Nichols. John, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be back on. And it is kind of incredible to think that it's 10 years.
It is. It's sort of shocking, actually.
I mean, and when you think back upon it, you know, I realize I've been on a lot, which I'm very honored by. But it's really incredible when you think of all the people who have been on over that 10-year period and some just amazing players in the national discourse, some of whom have passed on. You know, that's a painful reality.
Yeah,
but you start to realize that this is a record of folks who intervened in our political processes.
Yeah, we lost Chalmers Johnson, who was on several times.
Yeah. I know, Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn was on several times. Yeah, we've lost some people. And that's a list I don't want to add to.
No, it's not that, but it is. I mean, I look at it only in the sense that this is something that has been around long enough to have captured history.
Yeah.
And folks that you wouldn't hear anyplace else anyway, because so much of our media fails to cover the real thinkers in our times, but also people who contributed mightily over a long period and now, you know, have passed on or whatever. But it's a pretty epic journey. I'm glad to have been on it.
Well, I couldn't have done it without you, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I should let our listeners know we're recording this about, 8 days before going on air, 9 days before going on air, because I have to be out of the area on April 8th today when you're listening to this. So John is graciously doing this. So that means no phone calls today. John and I are going to do all the talking.
And, and that's not that hard for us.
That's not that hard for us to do. We could probably do one of those telethons if need be for 24 hours.
It'd be pretty painful. Yeah.
For the listeners. John, you have a new book out, Uprising. Mm-hmm. The subtitle.
It's How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street.
From Madison to Wall Street. And I think the title is self-evident. And I think you've talked about the Madison Uprising, the Wisconsin Uprising here on the air before. And you're going to be back 2 weeks from today on the 22nd for the Pledge Drive show. And we're going to talk, the book's going to be one of our pledge premiums. So we'll be talking about it at length then. But I do want to just get an update for our listeners. You cover Wisconsin as much as anyone based in Madison. And now we're going to air. We're taping this again 9 days before going to air, and also before the Wisconsin primary, which is a different matter.
Yeah.
But what's the state now of the recall efforts against Governor Scott Walker?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty set, so we can talk about it with a lot of clarity. The State Government Accountability Board, which is Wisconsin's elections board, has certified recalls against Scott Walker, who is the governor of Wisconsin, against Rebecca Clayfish, who is the lieutenant governor, against Scott Fitzgerald, who's the majority leader of the state Senate, and against three other state senators. Those recall elections will begin on May 8th with primaries in both parties. In fact, in Wisconsin, the way a recall works is you just force a new election. And so you have a primary, you have a general election. And so May 8th will be the primaries, and then June 5th will be the general election. And that's the technical data. The fascinating thing about it, the really remarkable thing is, this is the most wide-ranging interruption of a normal election pattern, normal election schedule, that we've ever seen in America. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
So like just a few months before a national election, you basically got a whole state going through.
Yeah, and something else, that you have two branches of a state government that could, on a particular day, June 5th, switch from control of one party to the other party, not on a normal election cycle, but on a cycle forced by the people. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's absolutely fascinating about what's happened in Wisconsin and what I think has influenced a lot of other states. This is not just a Wisconsin thing. There has been a seizing of the political process by citizens. They went to the streets initially, and they did exactly what the founders told them to do, assemble and petition for the redress of grievances. They demanded in amazing numbers, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people surrounding their state capital, occupying their state capital, rallying in the streets of every city, every crossroads town in Wisconsin, saying to the governor, we do not want you to impose an austerity agenda that destroys our public sector unions, that cuts our public education funding, that cuts our local services. We want you to tax big corporations and wealthy people. We think there's a better way to do this. The governor and his allies absolutely refused. They did not listen. They went ahead with radical structural changes, not just in labor law, not just in funding of programs, but also even in election law, changing to a voter ID, a very harsh voter ID law, putting in changes in all of the electoral cycles, actually changing election dates. It was such a radical initiative that in the views of, you know, mass numbers of Wisconsinites, it justified a pushback that took the form of a recall. This recall election, supported by literally millions of people who signed petitions, has, you know, shaken things up in ways that are quite remarkable. And I hope it never goes back, because I cover politics for a living. Mm-hmm. But I've gotten very tired of covering standard issue, predictable politics. This is so much better. It's so much more real, because this isn't politics on the schedule of the parties or the political players. This is politics on the schedule of the people, saying something objectionable has occurred, and we will not stand by and wait, you know, 4 years to see how it plays out.
You know, that I know this is really you love that. I know you well enough to know how important that is to you. And when you said that, it reminds me of a book you wrote about 5 years ago called The Genius of Impeachment, because it's very similar, I think, in what you were getting at in that book. Yeah. It's for our listeners' sake, that was a book during the second term of President George W. Bush, when there were a whole range of books coming out criticizing the Bush-Cheney administration for their conduct, and several making a fairly strong case that the violation of law was such that it merited impeachment and review trial by the Senate. And your book was similar in that sense, but it really made a much deeper, much more profound argument, I thought, that the whole notion of impeachment, was what you were arguing, was really in the Constitution for a reason, not to be ignored. They put it there for a reason, to get people involved in politics and to keep people in power on their toes. And that seems to be what the referendum process is very much like.
Well, I think this is goes to the core of it, because the founders of the American experiment had very little interest in elections. It's quite fascinating. If you go back and read their writings and, you know, read about the important events of their lives, the election day was a pretty secondary day. The election day as
governing is what mattered.
Governing was it mattered. Putting together the coalitions, forming the movements, the ideas mattered immensely. I mean, Jefferson would go on for weeks writing about ideas, but would had, you know, scant paragraphs about actual election campaigns. And this modern notion of elections as a great theater, something very much like the Super Bowl, right? You build up, you go through your primaries and that, and then you go through your conventions, and finally you get to the big game, and you have commentators and maps
and predictions.
The whole bit. That's a very modern construct. It is not how people thought of it even 100 years ago, and certainly not how the founders did. What they worried about was this. Once somebody got power, how do you check and balance them? And so, of course, they created what we know through the Constitution as a check and balance system. But then also, how do the people check and balance? If, for instance, and this is, you know, we often hear Madison talked about factions. You know, he was very afraid of factions. What Madison meant by factions and political parties was a group of aligned people who would take control not just of the presidency and the Congress, but also the courts. Now, this is something we can understand today.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the courts in a second.
It was anticipated. Yeah. And so that they put in a lot of structures to say, here's how the people can intervene. And certainly impeachment was a part of that. But as the modern election complex, the election industry, began to develop, and as corporations began to see elections as vehicles by which they could affect the changes they wanted in society, effectively get control of society. That's where you started to see the progressive reforms of a century ago come in. You know, we think we have these modern problems with corporations. The kind of realization of the threat of robber barons and corporate power came late 19th century, early 20th century. Progressives then intervened to, in effect, update the founding premise. If at the federal level you needed an impeachment power so that if somebody got out of control, you could check and balance them, so too at the state level you needed something. And in the period from about 1900 to 1925, many states across the country put in recall referendums and initiatives. These are people-powered electoral tools where citizens can go out, gather tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of petition signatures, and force either a new election for an office holder or force an election on an issue. And we sort of let a lot of those tools go dormant in many states for a long time. But what's happened, I think, with this current moment, and it is logical, it's an austerity moment, radical changes are being proposed. People looked around, what tool do we have to push back? And in Ohio, they found their veto referendum, an old referendum tool. In Wisconsin, they found the recalls. Interestingly enough, they did a veto referendum in Maine on some election law changes recently. They've done major recalls of legislators recently in Michigan, in Arizona, where they recalled the guy who wrote the anti-immigration laws. And so I think we're seeing across this country sort of a realization that we were given some tools a century ago to make real the promise of a democratic experiment, and they're being put into play, and it's a very exciting time. Much more exciting, I think, than presidential politics.
Yeah, or Supreme Court politics.
Yeah, very much, yes.
You know, the Supreme Court is, of course, the institution put in place by the Constitution to protect those rights from the legislature and the president from getting carried away to make sure liberties are not threatened. What's the check on the Supreme Court if, for what some through bad luck, you get a majority on that body that just basically decide they want to run the country in a particular way? Yeah. What options are there within our constitutional system to check them?
Well, it's very important to understand that the founders did not see the Supreme Court as a particularly powerful branch of government. The Supreme Court seized a lot of power.
Yeah, that whole thing about being checking on the constitutionality of stuff came after the Constitution.
Right. It was you had a very powerful set of Supreme Court justices and chief justices who in the in the period really from about 1820 to around 1850 began to really assert themselves as a much more powerful force. And people forget that there was a battle in this country. You could write many good books on this one. The Supreme Court actually occasionally would do something right. For instance, they basically took the side of Native Americans whose lands were being seized in the 1830s. And Andrew Jackson just said, have them enforce it. Mm-hmm. He just basically said, screw you, we're not going to pay attention to the Supreme Court. What's that? It was a complete dismissal. And
Jackson might have been ahead of his time.
Well, or behind it. He was behind it on the issue. Actually, the court was right. Yeah, yeah. But the fascinating thing is that this modern notion of the court being really the most powerful of all institutions, because it's the one that can tell a president.
The final word.
In fact, there's simply no question. We look back on it now, we realize that while the New Deal was a remarkable period in American history, it was profoundly tempered by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said to Franklin Roosevelt, there's all sorts of things you can't do. They shot him down again and again. He pushed back with proposals to perhaps expand the court unsuccessfully. But the bottom line is we've had a progression in our understanding of the court, which has been a very unhealthy one. And we've come to a point now where the court is seen as having complete dictatorial power. No matter how stupid a court's ruling is, it becomes a law of the land. They're definitional.
And we can combine this with the fact that one sector of the American society has sort of looked at the court strategically and has developed an idea that the people put in the court should be picked strategically to advance a particular
political. Yeah, pick young people who can serve a long time and are very, very vetted ideologically.
The issues will always come down on the side of property.
Absolutely. And it's important to understand that is not simply Republicans that do that. There are Democratic justices who are incredibly bad on a lot of corporate issues. So the fact of the matter is the court has really become the most conservative of our three branches of government. It's far more conservative, for instance, than Congress is today.
Yeah.
And more likely to defend a corporate order. One of the things is we don't cover the courts. We don't cover most institutions of government anymore in media. We cover an occasional court case, like the healthcare case of late. But that's just theater. On any given day, there are dozens and dozens of cases that the court is rejecting or taking up. And the interesting thing is that while the court has over the last 50 years, had something of a liberal reputation as regards some civil rights issues and some abortion rights issues, by and large, the court has, on corporate issues, on economic issues, become a more rigidly right-wing, more rigidly Wall Street-oriented institution than it's been at any time in, you know, certainly in modern history. Mm-hmm. So the court's a mess. And the interesting thing is that we do have a couple of checks and balances. We have two formalized checks and balances on it right now. Number one is impeachment. Justices can be impeached.
Is it the same as the president?
Absolutely. Yeah, same structure. You got to.
The House impeaches and the Senate votes.
Yeah, absolutely. Same rules. And it's very, very hard. It's a high hurdle. Yeah. But, you know, to be honest, I think that the corruption of the court, the level of corruption on the court, the clear connection between justices and their ideological background, and frankly, their economic connections to the interests that they are supporting through their spouses, through their family.
You know, the
ties.
Democrats are so spineless.
They would never do it.
That.
But no. the Republicans would in a second. Yes.
It would be the number one issue, getting rid of the impeaching the Supreme Court if they didn't like
them. Well, the Impeach Earl Warren movement was a pretty darn big
movement. Those were mild people compared to what we're dealing with today.
Absolutely. And so I think, and that was basically about race.
Yeah.
You know, civil rights. But so we do have the impeachment power. It is, you know, again, just as it isn't used sufficiently at the presidential level, it's not used sufficiently at the court level. The other power is one that you don't think of immediately, but it's the ability to pass a constitutional amendment. And that's...
Yeah, well, can't they ignore it?
Well, they might, but it's a bit... This is reality, that if the court...
If the pass a constitutional amendment saying the Supreme Court has to obey the Constitution?
Well, it wouldn't be a bad idea. But you do also say, okay, if the court makes the crazed interpretation that a corporation is a human being, as they did in the Citizens United ruling, then you have a right to amend the Constitution to basically say, it would be like if your child takes some rule, you know, and like fantasizes out some weird thing, and you say, no, let's write it down. Here's the actual rule of the household. Mm-hmm. So you would say to the Supreme Court, look, we understand that you are incapable. You do not have the skills of a first-year law student to actually read what's on paper or look at, you know, hundreds of years of precedent, 100 years of specific precedent on campaign finance law. You are not capable of that. So we, the people, are going to write it out in clearer terms.
Yeah,
corporations are not people.
You know, John, talk about that Citizens United case. We've gone over it on the show periodically over the last 2 years, a year and a half or so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you and I are writing a book now that we're still in the midst of, won't be done until next year or published till next year. And I know for that book, you've actually done a lot of research on the courts and how they got to the point in January of 2010 to make that decision. And this hasn't been published yet, but it's still an extraordinary history. Talk a little bit about how we got to January 2010 in Citizens United.
Well, it is a good story. And it's a story with a lot of intrigue, frankly. It makes for good drama. The best way to understand things is that America has never had a left-wing Supreme Court, but America did have a political moment in the 1960s, early 1970s, where rulings of the courts, as well as the pattern with changes in civil rights law that had expanded the electorate, the lowering of the voting age to 18, which was a radical move, much lost to history now, but taking it from 21 to 18 was a very big deal. All of these moves made America, frankly, a more liberal country, and not a social democratic country, but one that you could imagine briefly might be moving toward something more akin to what we see in the most stable and functional of European states, a Germany, perhaps, or even at least a little bit like Canada was in this period. That terrified power in this country. And the fascinating thing is the thing that scares power the most was the passage of a law that said that cigarette companies couldn't advertise on TV. That was like a wake-up call. And the tobacco industry sued in the courts. They tried to beat it, and they didn't win. And they were like, whoa, this is bad. We've lost the courts. This is a very, very scary thing. We need to kind of step back and think very, very seriously about how we create an infrastructure that sustains our corporate point of view, our corporate desires in the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. And Lewis Powell, who was an attorney for the tobacco companies and an attorney for a lot of corporate interests.
And a Democrat.
In the sense that George Wallace was a Democrat,
it was a Virginia Democrat.
Powell was not a flaming racist like some folks, but he was of the he came out of the massive resistance Southern Democrat. Yeah, I mean he was a member of the Richmond School Board. That was his only public office during the period of massive resistance. So you know, making
the period of segregation.
Yes. But it's not. I don't know. Paint Powell's a racist. I'm not particularly sure he was. I think it was a business decision, like everything else in the guy's life. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a memo in 1970-71 that was an absolutely fascinating piece of work. What that memo said was, you know, look, we're losing things in the courts and in the legislative level that we just can't afford to lose anymore. This is going to cost us money. We're getting environmental laws. We're getting regulations, and so. What I propose is that all of our Chamber of Commerce types, all of our corporate types, start to really put a lot of money in to creating an infrastructure that makes sure that we get control of the different branches of government, even at the state and local level. The Powell memo was just absolutely loved by everybody in the Chamber of Commerce world. It circulated around there. Literally, there now when you look at the paperwork, you see like letters to the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying, well, can you get me a copy of that Powell memo? You know, that looks like
some Huron statement of the new right.
This is hot stuff, man. I love this. And people whose names we know now, the Koch brothers, for instance, you know, very, very wealthy, powerful people loved this idea. Put your money in up front. Set up think tanks, set up groups, organizations like the Federalist Society and others that will nurture up a right-wing politics, a right-wing judiciary. And then the incredible thing about it was that Lewis Powell, who wrote this memo, had repeatedly turned down offers to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. He was a very, very prominent lawyer, and he was from the South. He fit perfectly into Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. Mm-hmm. Give me a Southern Democrat I can appoint to the court that will help me to appeal to Southern states.
Yeah.
He tried it with Carswell. He tried it with Haynesworth. These are Southern judges who had such racially inappropriate records and such ethically inappropriate records that they got rejected by the Senate. So then he finds Lewis Powell, who had never been a judge. Mm-hmm. That was very, very useful because he was then sort of clean on the record. Powell ends up having turned Nixon down because he didn't want to take the pay cut of being on the Supreme Court. But after he writes this memo and after this whole electrical moment where everybody says, yeah, yeah, that's what we got to do, he accepts Nixon's offer, goes on the U.S. Supreme Court, and you know, as we will write about in the book at some length, at key moments became the critical player in writing rulings on campaign finance law. And if you look back, you're going to find the genesis of Citizens United. You go back and you look at rulings in the late 70s, often with Lewis Powell as the essential author.
Writing the majority opinion.
Absolutely. Which, and in some cases, minority opinions that became the basis.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you really see where it all started back there. And you had a militant activist. You know, talk about a judicial activist. Here's a guy who wrote a memo saying this is how we want to change things, getting on the court, using his position on the court to really begin to move things much more toward a corporate desire, corporate wish list, if you will. And at the end of the corporate wish list was the ability to spend money to win elections, to buy elections without limit, so that if an election was important enough, you could just do whatever you had to, but also the ability to make the threat that you would do that. Because, of course, corporations do not want to spend a lot of money on politics. They much prefer to, you know, pocket the money or, you know, use it to set up new factories in China. But so this is not their desire to spend the money, but they want to have the hammer. They want to have the ability to say that we might.
Yeah.
And what we're watching now, the Citizens United ruling in 2010, the culmination of a series of rulings by John Roberts' court, have given them that hammer. This year, 2012, they are using the hammer with abandon. Mitt Romney's literally buying the Republican nomination.
I want to talk about the Republican process in a second, but first let me let listeners know. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney here on WILL AM 580. You're listening to the voice of John Nichols, of course. If you're a regular listener, you're familiar with John Nichols' voice. This is our 10th anniversary show. It was 10 years and one day ago that the very first episode of Media Matters went on the air, and every Sunday from 1 to 2 Central Time, we've been joining you since then. John Nichols was our first guest. He's been a guest at least 25 times.
I don't know if it's that many.
Yeah, it's twice a year.
No, twice a year for the fundraiser.
Plus every time you do a new book.
Because I'm willing to do the fundraiser with nobody else.
Yeah, well, being my best friend, it helps.
Do you know that actually the best fundraiser we ever had was not that long ago, and it was, remember Bill Moyers called in?
Remember Bill called?
And he was going on at length, and it was during the Wisconsin fight was in play. Mm-hmm. And he was, as a small D radical Democrat that he is, and in the best of sense, in the Jeffersonian, in the best part of the Jeffersonian tradition, Moyers was very excited about it. And so we're doing the fundraising. He's supposed to call in and do the standard pitch, you know, mm-hmm. give some money. But he was so into stuff that he actually was saying, it became this very interesting dialogue.
I remember that, yeah.
It was quite good.
We had Terry Gross called in once, too. We normally
she was great.
She was great, too. Yeah, she couldn't shut her up either.
That's what you want, man.
That's what
you
we want.
Scam them in on the fundraising and then keep them talking.
Get them going. Yeah. So, John, let's talk about the Republican primaries here in 2012. Mm-hmm. It seems to me you were getting, there's been an enormous amount of money spent.
It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. By any historical standards, we've seen it's like a gusher compared
to... It's unbelievable, and it's also unquantified, which is absolutely fascinating to me.
Explain that.
Well, we do not have the capacity to measure the crisis. And that's a fascinating thing because we don't have the infrastructure set up to measure it. We have a Federal Elections Commission. We have different, you know, watchdog groups and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, money is being spent in so many ways... In such wild variations.
It's not regulated at all, so no one...
Much of it's not. And so I actually cover politics for a living. I mean, it's my you know, side gig in addition to...
This show
and writing about media and all sorts of other things. But you know what? I have always done it from a childhood fascination with our electoral processes. You know, so as I have year after year, you know, election season after election season since the 1980s, I've been this year to Iowa. I've been to New Hampshire. You know, I've been to different states, you know, where we've had these, you know, the primaries and stuff. Everything's different. The money is flowing in ways you can't imagine. In Wisconsin, where we had primary is April 3rd, there was so much advertising on commercial radio, which is, of course, a place they love to do advertising. So much advertising on commercial radio that you literally had Romney and Santorum ads backing up against each other.
Which used to be not...
Well, they never did it, But now you'd have a Romney ad attacking Santorum, followed by a Santorum ad attacking Romney, followed by a Romney ad attacking Santorum.
Yeah.
And the incredible thing about that is that in addition to that being there, I was hearing these on liberal talk radio, not on conservative talk radio. So they have so much money that they're now doing wall-to-wall every place. And in Madison, Wisconsin, which is... And very much an equivalent of Urbana. It's a very liberal town.
And Champaign.
Champaign, too. It's a very liberal town, right? Madison.
Maybe not Champaign.
Madison liberals were taking 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 robocalls on their phone from Romney. Mm-hmm. These are people who are not going to vote. You know, I mean, there is no realistic measure that would, you know, you'd say, oh, we can buy this list. That's a smart move to do. They weren't buying this list. It's a smart thing to do. They're just buying everything.
The sea level's raising everywhere.
That's it. And when you get to that, you know, pure cacophony of money-slathered politics, you know, it becomes an incredibly destructive game because most of that advertising in all the states I've been through has been negative advertising meant to suppress turnout, not to increase it, not to be a campaign of ideas, but a campaign of attacks. And so we end up in a situation where at the end of what's actually been a very competitive Republican presidential race, where the front runner has changed several times. You've had people fight from the back of the field to the front. You've had ongoing ideological battle, legitimate ideological battle between a center right corporatist Romney, a social right theocratic Santorum, you know, Ron Paul out there with a libertarian view, and Newt Gingrich offering, you know, something else. All of this stuff in play. And yet we're going to end up with a lower turnout. significantly lower turnout than 2008 when John McCain wrapped the thing up relatively early. And, you know, there wasn't. Was there anyone
near the, I mean, the striking story here that's not getting much attention is just the plummeting turnout.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And on the Democratic side, too.
And,
people are just walking away.
I think that some people don't think about that because Obama's not being challenged. But explain what happened.
It's one of my – to me, it's one of the most fascinating things going on. We actually have a very pure measure on this. In 1996, Bill Clinton was running for re-election as president of the United States as a Democrat who had taken his hits, but he was unopposed in the primaries. And he had a very visceral Republican opposition that had come to power 2 years earlier. I mean, the parallels between Clinton 96, Obama 2012 are immense.
Except that Clinton had a much better economy.
He did have a better economy, but actually still the better economy stuff came later in that stage.
But it was moving more dramatically.
But it had been a shaky one, you know, and you know, even adjusting for that, looking at states that actually have better economic patterns than others, this turnout has just been disastrous. You know, it's as much as 30% of a drop off in Democratic voting and parallel drop offs in Republican voting. People are just, you know, they're just throwing their hands up and saying this is not a worthy endeavor.
It's a massive disconnect between the electoral system and then going out and talking to people in this country
who are more engaged than ever.
Who are more concerned about the future, who are deeply concerned about where this country is going. Yet the electoral system seems to offer nothing.
Well, and I give you, and I have, I
except
follow
fear. So you vote out fear, of fear,
yeah, and
of
that
the
may
outside.
Come to be the pattern of the fall.
That's basically why you vote.
But I have followed. I follow global politics very, very closely, and because I think it's A, instructive, and B, often much more interesting. And France is playing out a presidential race at the exact, you know, during this period now. It's going to have the elections later in April. And the fascinating thing is to watch in France where they actually have choices. Mm-hmm. And they have a two-tier system. So the first of two elections, it's an initial stage. And out of that, you have multi-candidates there, and then two come out to do the runoff. So people are able to actually vote in the first election for what they want. Mm-hmm. Second election, then they can build coalitions, go up. It is so much different. And frankly, I'm going to say bluntly, it is so much better than the system we have. Because, you know, we have this moment of, you know, this great battle over austerity, great battle over corporate power. And this is a global fight. And in France, you know, there's Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is the candidate of the Left Front. And
that was good, John. Say that again.
It's Jean-Luc Mélenchon. It took me about quite a while to learn how to pronounce it. I was looking at it on the page, being a good Midwesterner. But he is an absolutely fascinating candidate. Started out with about 5% of the vote. Mm-hmm. He's running far to the left. He's saying, everything about austerity is wrong. That instead of cutting pay, instead of, you know, making people work longer hours, instead of cutting services, we should go the exact opposite direction, whole different vision on, you know, global power, whole different vision on how you interrelate with Europe and the rest of the world, very different foreign policies. All this guy has now risen to third place finish. And, of course, all the media was always like, oh, well, the alternative to the major parties would be fascism, right, or the hard right. But no, this is a guy coming on the left. He appears to have brought the working class back into a left stance, built incredible coalitions. The other day he had a rally at the Bastille where his supporters marched on the Bastille, and 120,000 people showed up. The organizers had anticipated 30,000.
Wow.
And so what I'm telling you is that globally, where you have more choices and a politics that is really driven by ideas, because everything I just described about this guy was all ideas, you know, he's gone from 5% to 15-16% in the polls. He is now a very serious factor influencing the whole of the electoral process. We just don't have any phenomenon like that in America. We have no parallel, and we have very few vehicles by which to do it. And as more money comes into our politics, I find our system to be, you know, increasingly frustrating. And I don't think my frustration is, you know, a solo frustration or that of, you know, some sort of analyst.
Well, I think
it parallels where people are at.
As economists would say, people are voting with their feet. They're not voting. And there's no evidence they're not concerned about political issues. They just don't think the system is.
Well, and that's why I use the French model to say that when you are given a real alternative. I'll give you a great example of the French model. I think it's very relevant to a lot of stuff we're talking about. The Standard & Poor's downgraded France, just as the United States was downgraded. When the United States was downgraded, all we had in this country was sort of a media flourish of Republicans saying Obama's a bad guy, and Obama saying, well, this is all somebody else's fault. Very personality-driven dialogue.
Yeah.
The difference was, in France, Mélenchon went and they pulled a truck up in front of the Standard & Poor's office, and he got on the back of the truck with a speaker system and had about, you know, 8,000 people chanting resistance, you know, no analyst agency can downgrade a republic. You know, and it was this incredible pushback. It was such a powerful moment that the major parties had to respond to it. And in fact, Sarkozy, the supposedly conservative leader of France, actually was condemnatory of the ratings agency and started talking about doing financial transactions taxes and things like that. What I'm saying is that, you know, having a more diverse politics, having a more open politics is less about money, more about ideas, allows you to respond to actual developments and have a politics that is very relevant, very real, very immediate and fluid.
Yeah, that's such a great point, John, because I think, you know, sometimes we have the politicians today just surrounded by, you know, 10-foot walls of $100 bills that really they don't need to pay any attention to the population as long as they pay attention to the Sheldon Adelsons and, and Goldman Sachs and all the people who bankroll their campaigns.
And they wouldn't think to move, you know. You don't actually change your pattern.
Yeah, it'd
be like McDonald's saying, well, we're not going to do hamburgers anymore. You know, it's like, no, this is what we do. And it really is, it's deeply unsettling because if America had one reputation in the world, it was this is, and still people talk about this, this is a country where, you know, you kind of do big things.
Yeah.
See a problem, deal with it. You know, it's the famous World War II analogy where, you know, just about anybody in any other country said, we couldn't have beaten fascism. Couldn't have done it. The rest of the world just didn't have it. We needed America to step in and to, and under Franklin Roosevelt, to have that vision, that four freedoms vision that made it more than simply an old struggle between
nations
and powers, but really a struggle for something deeper and more beautiful. And, you know, you think of it, this is the country that did that. And now, you know, we can barely pull off an interesting election.
John Nichols, I'm going to pull away from contemporary politics now because we're going to be back in 2 weeks and we're going to be talking about contemporary politics during the pledge
drive. And begging
show.
People for money.
And begging people for money. But we're going to talk about contemporary politics. One of the things I don't think my listeners, well, some of them will be familiar with this part of your background, but you are a keen student of American history as much as anyone I know and have a knowledge of American history that is staggering to me. Including knowing all the vice presidents, which I think puts you on the short list.
The short list of the
lunatic fringe.
Although I met a 6-year-old kid who had just learned the presidents.
Oh, God, is he related to you?
No, it's a little girl, and they're thinking of it as some sort of perhaps, you know, thing that they may have to have checked out by a doctor or something, but there is interest there.
I think she's probably going to end up being a reporter.
I think she'll do very well.
But in any case, we talk about history all the time, and I learned so much talking to you. I just wanted you to talk about a couple of people in American history who aren't widely known, but they're very interesting figures. In American history, they've had a lot of influence over it. They might have had more. And the first one I want to start with is someone I suspect very few of our listeners have ever heard of, named Hannibal Hamlin.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I know you've talked to me
about. Oh, my God, he's the biggest of the big.
And he is, who was he, and why is he such an interesting figure in American history, and how might American history have changed if just one little thing had been different?
I imagine someone's riding in a car through central Illinois right now going, Hannibal Hamlin, Well, and here's the deal. I believe that, you know, we've had this horrible case with Trayvon Martin in Florida, the killing of a young African-American, reminding us how, frankly, how limited our progress has been, how little we have bent the arc of history toward justice.
Yeah.
And you ask yourself, well, what are the roots of this? Why is our country so unable to deal with some of these issues? Why haven't we wrestled successfully with this? And the answer has a lot to do with Hannibal Hamlin. Hannibal Hamlin was a U.S. senator from Maine in the 1850s. He was a Democrat who switched to the Republican Party because the Republican Party was more anti-slavery. He was a Mainer. He was very anti-slavery. Considered to be one of the best people in the Senate, one of the most capable folks. In 1860, when Abraham Lincoln was nominated for president, Lincoln looked around and he said, I have to have somebody who can actually make Congress work for me. I can be a visionary president, but I need a vice president who's really good. And so he asked Hannibal Hamlin to be his vice president. Hamlin was playing cards with friends when the offer came, and he said, no, I don't want to be vice president of the United States. I have no desire for that. And the person said, well, but Mr. Hamlin, you know, this is important. Mr. Lincoln wants you to do this. And Hamlin looked, put his cards down. He says, "Is it for the cause?" Which was, "Is this about ending slavery?"
Mm-hmm.
And the people said, "Yes." And he said, "Then I'll do it." And so he became vice president of the United States. He's an incredibly capable, like super mm-hmm. vice president, who actually, when Lincoln got all wiggly and not certain about whether to do the Emancipation Proclamation on New Year's Eve, 1862 into 1863, Hannibal Hamlin hooked up a carriage with a horse and said, "Mr. President, let's go for a carriage ride." And they rode around the streets of Washington for hours on New Year's Eve with Hamlin, you know, building up his confidence to do an Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Hamlin was the driving force in this. And then in 1864, Lincoln was facing what he thought might be a tough re-election. 1864 began as a, I think it might, much like this year, you know, began as a very, very tough year for the president.
The war was not going this way.
No, it wasn't going well. It ultimately ended up being a very easy year for the president. Yeah. But Lincoln got scared early on, and he's seeing, you know, threat of Northern Democrats breaking from him, you know, all the problems. So he dumped Hamlin from the ticket. He picked a drunken Tennessee senator, mid-South senator named Andrew Johnson as his vice president. So Hamlin was gone. And, of course, we know the rest of the story. Here you had one of the most capable, passionate opponents of slavery, but also a visionary legislator who was actually probably quite capable of seeing the country through the post-Civil War period,
mm-hmm.
pushed off the ticket and out of our politics. And then you put a drunk, an incompetent drunk, in as vice president. And, of course, Lincoln was shot less than 20 days, barely 20 days, after he was sworn in for a second term. So the entire post-Civil War era, defined by incompetence and by somebody who had very little evidence of being, you know, committed to a real resolution of our challenges with race and slavery and segregation. When you had this opportunity that close of a guy who would have, I think, seen us through Reconstruction in a functional way that would have rebuilt the South, but made it a integrated South and begun a process of really moving this country to where it needed to be. And so the line I always say is that the story of Hannibal Hamlin really is the story of Abraham Lincoln's critical error, you know, Abraham Lincoln's devastating mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't like to talk about Lincoln as somebody who could make horrible mistakes, but I use the Hamlin story a lot as an example of why we should take our picks for vice president very, very seriously. And I don't think that presidential candidates do that all that often. And
except
it's a really
John McCain.
Oh, there you go. And but I'm saying this is a very big deal because who you pick,
absolutely.
You know, you don't know. We have actually had quite a few presidents who have died in the very early days.
Yeah, tip a canoe.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt in his fourth term.
That's true.
And interestingly enough, the parallels are so striking.
Yeah, well, I was actually, that's the other vice president, that the more recent mm-hmm. one, that I, Henry Wallace, talk a little bit about, you know, what the world might have looked like had FDR kept Henry Wallace. Well, who was Henry Wallace? Why was he thrown off the table?
Sure. Henry Wallace was an Iowan. He was a Republican and a progressive Republican who came out of farm country. His dad had been a really prominent figure, probably one of the most beloved commentators on farm and rural issues in America. Mm-hmm. They ran a thing called Wallace's Weekly, a very successful publication. They were also great innovators in, you know, hybrid corns and things like that. So they were quite wealthy. And Franklin Roosevelt was a very smart political player. When he came to power, he knew he had to reach out to rural America. And he had a lot of farm policies, a lot of farm plans, but he needed somebody who could actually speak to rural America. So he made Henry Wallace, this very young, good-looking guy from Iowa, who had never held public office, his Secretary of Agriculture.
This is his first term?
Yeah, in his first term, actually first two terms. And Wallace was an incredibly dynamic figure. I know it's hard to imagine this because I don't think most people in America could name the Secretary of Agriculture now.
Well, that was an era when about 20% of the population was on farms.
So. Yes, and when rural, you know, this concept of rural America, I mean, there was such a wealth-poverty divide between urban and rural that if you lived in rural America, you didn't have electricity, you know. So Wallace became the face of this incredible outreach to rural America. And at that point, the way the country was structured, that was a big part of what made Roosevelt successful, because it got him, you know, rural states voting for him. And when he had these great Roosevelt landslides, Wallace was a big part of that. And Roosevelt loved Wallace. And so in 1940, he made Wallace his vice president. The problem was that Wallace was a genuine left-winger. Mm-hmm. There was simply no doubt. He's probably the most instinctually left-wing person to be vice president of the United States in the modern era. There were some other folks who came pretty close. But I mean, he was quite...
Really? Who?
Actually, you know, I'm going to tell you, I think Hubert Humphrey.
Okay.
You know, I think he really was, you know, I think we might have missed a big one there in 68.
Okay.
And of course, Spiro Agnew before he changed. Wallace was an amazing figure, and he looked at the world in very different ways. He believed in the possibility of creating a post-war peace with Soviet Union and countries which others did not believe in. He saw geopolitics very differently. Had he remained as vice president, I think the post-war era would have been radically different. I don't have any question of that, both domestically and internationally. But in 1944, people knew... You know, there's a great book about Roosevelt's 1944 campaign. I think it was Stanley Weintraub just wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible book because it talks about how sick Roosevelt was. It opens with a scene where Roosevelt is collapsed on the floor of a train car in Los Angeles, I think it was, you know, like early in 1944, and how all the people around Roosevelt were quite fearful that he might die during the campaign.
Before the election. That
he was unbelievably sick.
Yeah.
And they created this whole structure to make it look like he was well. But, you know, this is like the vultures gathering around. They knew this guy was not going to make it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a coup within the Democratic Party. I mean, there's simply no doubt about it that efforts were made to make sure that Wallace wasn't the nominee. And the weird thing was Roosevelt was not party to this. It wasn't his desire. He wanted Wallace. But the pressure became so great that he buckled. And then, though, the interesting thing was he still wanted a leftist. He still wanted a progressive. And so he sent a note to the convention. He was not at the convention. Presidents didn't go in those days. And on the note he wrote, William O. Douglas, the Supreme Court judge, a very liberal Supreme Court judge.
Yeah, sure.
And then underneath it, he wrote Harry Truman.
Hmm.
And he said, these are my, you know, these are, if I can't have Wallace, these are options I would consider. And the people at the convention took the note, tore it up, and said, oh, the president suggested Harry Truman. And if, you know, if a fallback might be William O. Douglas.
Uh-huh.
And so they reversed it because they knew the delegates, if Douglas's name had been the first one, that would have been the pick. So were it not Henry Wallace, we could well have had William O. Douglas, the great liberal Supreme Court justice, who would have been a very, very different president.
Oh, he was a legendary figure on the court.
And we ended up with Harry Truman, who is, you know, history has been very generous to Truman. And he was a dynamic figure in many ways, but it was a mess of a presidency. And really, in many ways, Harry Truman's presidency set so many of the outlines and the frames for the modern era, both in good and bad. I mean, Truman was better on race than a lot of people expected, but he was, on foreign policy, he was an incredibly weak player who was not able to position the United States in the world in a way that we could function with the Soviet Union as a strong Western force, but not as one that was in a kind of a Cold War circumstance. The Cold War really began under Truman, and we continue to live in a Cold War era to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, we spend money on defense as if we are still, you know, 2 minutes from midnight.
That's right. Our guest today, John Nichols on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is our 10th anniversary show. We went our first program 10 years ago yesterday, April 7th, 2002. This
the
show
day
was...
that shall live in infamy.
Yeah. this show is recorded a week or so before we went on our on-air to now. John Nichols will be back 2 weeks from today for a live two-hour fundraising program on April 22nd. And we'll be talking about contemporary politics then, as well as trying to get you all to give us as much
That's
money
our big
as we
goal.
Can.
Yeah.
As we possibly can. John, we've only got a few minutes left, and I do want to... get back to contemporary politics now and talk a little bit about some of the key races that you see coming up that our listeners should keep their eyes on, especially Senate races or House races around the country that you think are, you know, where there's really a sharp difference and where there's, you know, key people at play.
Yeah. Well, let's begin with the core concept that Barack Obama is going to get reelected president.
You really think so?
Yeah, I kind of think so.
Really? Even after the Koch brothers?
Yeah, all the money fly around, you know, all that. But at the end of the day, you have a relatively improving economy. The latest unemployment figures are even better. You know, it's almost like each month gets a little better. And it's not like Obama can't raise money. I mean, he's actually quite good at it. And so I think he'll have a relative starting gate equality on money. He'll have a relatively improving economy. He'll have a Republican Party that has basically illustrated why you wouldn't want these people to run your country. And so I suspect he'll get reelected. And I don't think that's going to mean much.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, okay, if you just simply reelect Barack Obama with the exact same kind of basic outline in Congress, Republican-controlled House, perhaps even a Republican Senate. His second term will be one of, you know, kind of managing crisis, not any progress whatsoever. And so the question then becomes, is there a pattern in our House and Senate races that could give us something different and something better?
Mm-hmm.
And much of that depends on Obama. It's how he runs for re-election. If he runs soft for re-election, simply desiring to maintain the office, then we're in a pretty bad situation. That's sort of the Nixon 72 model. Nixon won very big, but Democrats actually improved their position in Congress. And so Nixon got reelected.
Yeah.
Big landslide, but it didn't mean a thing because he ended up having a Congress that wasn't going to do what he wanted to do.
Well, then he had Watergate show up, too.
Came pretty quick, and then they tried to impeach him. And in a sense, it was sort of like Reagan in 84. You know, Reagan got reelected by a big margin, very comfortable margin. But he didn't have the House. And in fact, in the Senate, there was a little bit of movement toward the Democrats. And so you end up with these situations where simply getting reelected president isn't that big a deal. If Barack Obama runs soft and does not dramatically change how the House and Senate goes, his second term is going to be more deeply disappointing, I think, in many ways than his first. So the question is, what's out there? Well, the answer to that question is women, and it's one of the most fascinating stories of 2012. There are a group of Senate seats. The Senate was supposed to be lost. The Democrats were supposed to lose it without a question.
What's the current split in the Senate?
Well, it's incredible because we're coming off the 2006 election,
which was a huge Democratic one.
So the pattern was, so basically, you've almost got a 2-to-1 Democratic advantage in the seats that are up, but many of them are very vulnerable seats in places like Montana and southern states. And so, you know, these are seats that Democrats are very likely to lose at least a few of. And frankly, if they lose, you know, more than a handful of them, they're...
Yeah, because what's the current spread?
Depending on how you... Yeah, but well, you got to count... The thing is, you're 53, but you got to count Lieberman and then Bernie Sanders. And so it's kind of a...
Big caucus with the...
It's an amorphous caucus.
Yeah.
And then you got people like Ben Nelson and folks like that, you know, so it gets a little shaky all over the place. So Democrats, frankly, they were looking at a very bad pattern, and then something weird happened. There's a pattern of women who are running, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, Mazie Hirano in Hawaii, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, all of them running even or better in their races, meaning that in a bunch of states where it was expected that the Democrats were going to lose seats, there's a good chance they're going to win. And in some of them, they're going to, in the case of like an Elizabeth Warren, they're actually going to win a Republican seat. I think that's very possible. You got Tim Kaine, who's actually a surprisingly good guy for Virginia, running ahead down there. And so there is the rough outline of a situation where you could actually get a more liberal Senate than what we've got right now, mainly driven by a group of women who...
We've only got about 20 seconds left. Quick, what about the House?
The House is a bit more of a mess, but that's Obama's decision. He has to run a populist progressive campaign. If he doesn't, there's no way Democrats retake the House.
Is it possible that the Democrats could retake the House?
Absolutely, but you have to give people... you have to give a whole lot of young people, a whole lot of people of color, and a lot of young working women especially, a reason to come to the polls.
Besides you're not
going to
come scared of Republicans.
Yeah, that's not enough. You're going to have to give them a progressive populist vision that is actually worthy of walking across the street to vote. If Obama did that, the House could switch. If he doesn't, the best he can hope for is his reelection and a Democratic Senate, which is basically where we're at right now.
John Nichols, as always, my brother, thank you for joining us for the full hour today on Media Matters. It's a pleasure to have you here on our birthday.
Happy birthday and happy 10th anniversary.
Your anniversary, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for taping today's show. We will be back live with you a week from today, and then 2 weeks from today, we'll be back with John for the two-hour pledge drive on April 22nd. Thank you all listeners for 10 great years, and see you soon. Bye-bye.
Each week on Media Matters, host Bob McChesney and his guests discuss the role and responsibility of the media in our society. You're invited to join Bob and his guest John Nichols for a two-hour pledge special on Sunday, April 22nd from 1 to 3 p.m. We encourage your pledge, your comments, and your participation during the discussion.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The weather in central Illinois today is sunny. That's the word for most of the week. Today, some gusty winds and a high of 67. Tonight, down to 41 degrees, up to 65 Monday, another sunny but breezy day, winds gusting as high as 33. Overnight Monday, mostly clear and breezy, the low 35. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.